Hello, Ed Doolan here, and welcome to Ken Dodd.
Happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. To me, this world is a wonderful place. I'm the luckiest human in the human race. I've got no silver and I've got no gold, but I've got happiness in my soul. Happiness to me is an ocean tide, a sunset fading on a mountainside, a big old heaven full of stars above, when I'm in the arms of the one I love. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Happiness is a field of grain, turning its face to the falling rain. I see it in the sunshine, breathe it in the air. Happiness, happiness everywhere. A wise old man told me one time, happiness is a frame of mind. When you go to measuring a man's success, don't count money, count happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. Oh, happiness, happiness, the greatest gift that I possess. I thank the Lord that I've been blessed with more than my share of happiness. I got more than my share of happiness.
G'day, Doddy.
Great. By Jove, how discombobulating. To hear that again, that was 1963 or 64. So it's 40 years ago.
You had some big hits.
I was very young. That was me. Yes.
As I was trying to say, you've had some big hits, haven't you?
Oh, yes. So I've had about, well over 30 songs in the top 20. Yeah. The big ones were Happiness, Tears, The River, Think of Me Wherever You Are, Broken Hearted. I was very fortunate, Ed. I was very lucky. In those days, in the 1960s, most entertainers, you were given a song by the music publisher or the record company. They are going, make a disc of that. And you have to do it, you know. But I was able to choose my songs. So, because I was given lots of songs, and the people at EMI were very kind. And a man called Jimmy Phillips, who was a music publisher, they were very good, and they gave me, used to give me three or four songs, half a dozen songs a year, and I'd pick a couple out. But I'd pick some marvellous song, wonderful, but also I wasn't the greatest picker in the world, because I turned down, for instance, I said, no, it's too much like Down by the Old Mill Stream, and it was, I love you because you are, and yeah, I turned that down. I also turned another song down. I said, no, it's really like a Sally Army song, this, and oh, viva España, today we're off to sunny. Yeah, so I wasn't right all the time, but some of the time I was, and I had lovely people with me, you know, the Mike Sams singers. They were absolutely charming, lovely people.
With your voice, was there a decision, should I go into singing or should I become a comic?
No, I don't think so. No, I love singing. We all love singing. We're all very musical. We all love singing in our house. We had to, because there's no lock on the bathroom door. But we all love singing, and we came from a very musical family. My father, he had a musical ear shaped like a trombone. No, it wasn't. No, he did. He played the saxophone, which is an ill wind that nobody blows good. And we all loved singing, and I was in the church choir till they found out where the noise was coming from. So I genuinely, it was the comicking. When I used to go to variety bills, my father used to take us around to different theatres. I noticed that the engine driver, you know, as a little boy, I noticed that the engine driver of a variety show was always a comedian. So I said to my dad when I was about 11 or 12, I said, Dad, how do you comed? And he told me.
What was your first paid gig?
First paid gig was St. Edward's Orphanage, on a Christmas day. It was about half a mile from where we live in Notting Ash. And the Father Superior called me into his office, and he gave me half a crown. See, which was great, and I tied it up in ribbon, and that was my first piece. Then about a month later, the headmaster of the school, I was at the junior school, Nottingham, invited me to do a parent-teacher's social, and for that one, he gave me a shilling. So, you see, I learned a very, very important lesson in children's ed, how to take a cut gracefully. You've got to take a cut gracefully.
Listen, for the benefit of the audience...
I wasn't a comic in those days. I was a ventriloquist, wasn't I?
Yes.
See, he'll tell you. It was Dickie Mint, he's sitting here.
For the benefit of our listeners, Ken and I have spoken on a number of occasions, and I've never actually ever got through the interview. I just think you should know this before we start.
Oh, you did. I let you say good evening, and good afternoon, good morning, according to which time it was going out.
Whatever we're transmitting.
I never made fun of you because you weren't of this country, are you? I mean, you're from...
Yes, the antipodes.
For another land, of course. You seem to be losing a little bit of your brr now. You know, one time it was, hello, Ken. Well, you know what I mean.
G'day, Ken. How are you?
G'day.
Nice talking to you.
But now it's you're going more of a Brummie now, aren't you?
Well, I've been in Birmingham a long time.
You'll be talking about Enoch and Eli soon. I'll get you some lessons, electrocution lessons from Tommy Munden.
What are your... he's a great star. What are your accents like? You're pretty good, aren't you?
Not bad. It's all to do with how you hear them, and then you try to reproduce them. Yeah, yes. Some people are better than others, but I can do most of them. And then it comes in very handy because I can tell Enoch and Eli jokes, and then when I go up north, why, you know, you're a canny lad, Michael Owen. Oh, don't you say a word about Alan Shearer, Michael Owen. So do the Geordie, and hey, then if you know, hey, it's good crack, hey. So and then like further down south it are, my dears. Hello, my lovely. Hello, my handsome. And that's the men to each other.
But this is all part of identifying with the audience anyway, and doing a bit of that sort of material wins them over pretty quickly, I'd have thought.
Oh, you have to learn to points of reference, points of contact. You have to talk something relevant, that's what it is. So when in Rome, do the Romanians do?
So, I was.
That's where the Diddy Men came from. The Diddy Men came from. Somebody said to me once, about 1954, 55, soon after the Temple Revolution. You know, Dad, he said, you get on very well with children. I said, yeah, I went to school with them. You know, he said, well, you ought to find a point of contact. So lo and behold, I went out about down the bottom of our garden to think. I often do that. I often go to the bottom of the garden and wait until the tortoise gets there, then turn it around the other way. But and all of a sudden, I saw these little men. Little Diddy men.
Yeah.
And that's where they all came from. I was, at the time, I was doing your job. I was doing a radio, presenter.
Presentation.
And, thank you. I was doing radio presentation. And I was doing Housewife's Choice. I was the first comic to do Housewife's Choice.
Yeah.
And I was I got told off for not playing enough records. As many. Because I used to say, and here is a song, a record for all those men who are driving past work. and the Diddy Men were, so that was their debut. And so I realised I'd have to get them an Englishman, an Irishman, a Scotsman, and a Welshman. And, all the others, you know.
Yeah, that's great. Now, as I've been trying to say since we started the interview, I was watching Kenneth Branagh's Hamlet
on
the box a little while ago.
Kenneth Albrand, yeah.
And who should turn up?
Miming.
As Yo.
Yes, Yorick. He phoned me up, Kenneth Albrand phoned me one day and he said, Ken, how would you like to play in Hamlet? Well, I said, I've got the legs for it, you know, I can do it, you know. No, it's not Hamlet. How would you like to play the part of Yorick? I said, he's a skull. Ah, yes, he said, but we're going to show him in a flashback in the film when he was fully fleshed. So there I'm standing one day in this huge banqueting hall, this huge camera. So the camera, the crane and all that, about six or seven people all hanging onto it. It looked like it was the size of a people carrier.
Yeah.
Going crapping around the table, and right opposite me is the beautiful, voluptuous Julie Christie. To my left is Derek Jacobi, and to my right is Brian Blessed, and then the junior Hamlet over there. And he said, he couldn't actually put words into my mouth because we can't invent words for Willie. But he said, would you tell some jokes? So I'd sussed this. I would have to do this. So I got I'd swatted up on some actor and actresses jokes, you know. So, and of course the actors, they around the table, they were hooting and laughing. If anybody's ever the trouble trying to lip read, I'll be in trouble. But but it was very enjoyable.
Tears.
Except getting up in the morning. God, you've got to be in the makeup chair by 6:30. An unearthly hour.
Oh, dear.
They're shepherd's hours.
Tears for souvenirs. Where did that come from?
That was, as I say, I sent these songs and we recorded them. It was actually, to begin with, Tears, about 1920-something, I don't know, probably before I was born. It was a waltz written by an American man, Al Capano. He must have, that must be a gag, Al Capano.
But did tremendously well with it.
Well, Jimmy Phillips said, this would go, if you put this into four, as a sort of a slight country feel, you might have one. So we did it. And when you used to do recordings in those days, you'd do three in an afternoon at Abbey Road. Yeah. And I remember one was Tears, one was The River, and one of the other one was. And we used to get the wax dubbings. I was at the Palladium at the time. I was doing this 42 weeks at the Palladium, twice nightly. God, right. And I played it to visitors that come in, and people say, oh, I like that one, The River, because it was a beautiful melody. And then one day somebody said, that Tears one, that's a real Back of the Sharra song, real Back of the Coach song. You know, I said, that's it, that's the one we do then. So we released it about the May or the June, and it stayed in the charts for, about 20-odd weeks.
And knocked the Beatles off number one.
No, it kept them off. It didn't knock them off. I don't think it did. It kept them out of number one for, about a dozen weeks. So 2 million. 2 million. And this was in the boom time of rock and roll, Beatles, Rolling Stones, Elvis Presley. But I think people just wanted a change.
Okay, let's have a listen to... This is Doddy Rocky.
It's very slow and it's very mournful. But it's... don't forget, the last line means, turn our tears of regret once more to tears of happiness. So that's so that makes it all right.
Tears for souvenirs are all you left me. Memories of a love never meant. I just can't believe you could forget me. After all those happy hours we spent together, but tears can't mend a broken heart, I must confess. Let's forgive and forget, turn our tears of regret once more to tears of happiness. Tears have been my only consolation, but tears can't mend a broken heart, I must confess. Let's forgive and forget, turn our tears of regret once more to tears of happiness.
Let's forgive and forget. Turn our tears of regret once more to tears of happiness.
Cheers. 1965, that.
Yeah.
1965, the same year I came to the Birmingham Hippodrome in pantomime, Humpty Dumpty, and the record still stands. We ran right through till, I think we gave Easter eggs away on the stage.
Really?
And it was a great show. We did Humpty Dumpty there.
Earlier we mentioned your appearance in Hamlet. Can we talk about what happened when you went to Stratford to deliver a little lecture?
Yes, they phoned me up from the Royal Shakespeare, and they said, would you like to come and give us a talk, a lecture, you know, a penny lecture, we're going to give us a talk on comedy? Well, I thought, they were kidding. I said, me? I said, me? Well, I've done a little bit of Shakespeare. I said, no, we'd like to. So I trotted along. It was part of their a week of examining and theorising and analysing comedy. So I went along there, and it was most enjoyable. I was supposed to speak for, how long was I supposed to do? An hour. I think we did 2 hours.
That'll be right.
Talking about the great William, and I never realised, but to do this, I had to swat up again on Shakespeare. So I read, my father had a theory that if you wanted to know anything, you go to the library. So I got a half a dozen books out on Willie Shakespeare's life. And I never really, it's so interesting, really is. There's politics, there's conflict, there's politics, religion, there's rivalry. He was quite a good businessman. I never realised how good a businessman. I'm quite envious.
What about the humour of those times?
The humour of those times? We laugh at the same things today as they were there, the same subjects, men and women, mostly men and women, romance, sex, if you're allowed to say it on this program, buying and selling, you know, money, wealth, intrigue, people pretending to be somebody that they're not, you know, disguises, mistakes. So this exactly the same thing, but in a different language. Because he was the maestro of the English language. He was a poet. He was an actor. He was a dramatist. He was such a wonderful man, a genius, a beautiful poet. It was his choice of words and where he put them and the rhythms and when you really start reading Shakespeare and try to understand him. I played Malvolio here in Twelfth Night, and if I wasn't on the stage, the tannoy would be going on with the other actor, the text of the play comes through, and every now and again, it was like suddenly switching a light on in your head. You think, oh, that's what he meant when he said, all the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. And we are, we're all pretending, we're all acting. You're pretending to be a radio presenter, I'm pretending to be a comedian. I think I'm making a better fist of it than you.
Thank you so much for that.
Well, you hardly speak, do you? You hardly speak. That's me. You're so inarticulate. You know, here's me, Patrick, and you don't say, Ken, I'd like to ask you a meaningful question.
Ken, I'd like to ask you a meaningful question.
Good lad.
It'll be a waste of time because you won't answer it. You've been doing so much research into humour all your life, really. Yeah. And I'd have thought that this Shakespearean work must have opened up a whole new avenue for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, when you say reach, I'm only a comic from Notty Ashman. I'm very interested in comedy, and my passion, my obsession is finding the different styles and the different... See, when you say the word humour or the comedy, it's like saying the word music. There are different kinds of, there are all different kinds and styles of music, from classical to rock and roll and country and western. Well, it's the same with comedy and humour. There's all different kinds of comedians and all different kinds of material that they use, all different styles. So it's fascinating just to delve and to listen and to analyse and to theorise how they did it and how Shakespeare did it. He was a great one for puns, you know. Puns, yeah. Puns are marvellous things. I always think puns is like a little gateway between two fields of thought. And if you can open the gate and get through, you can have some good laughs.
love is like a violin, with its strings around your heart, soft and sweet as dreams begin. Sadly crying when you part, make my heart your violin. Play it now and tell me this, in the music of a kiss, let me hear you say, I love you. A violin is tender when love is young and shy. It knows the thrill. The heartache of goodbye. Its song may bring desire and melancholy too. For that caress of rapture that only can give to you. Love is like a violin, with its strings around your heart, soft and sweet as dreams begin, sadly crying when you part, make my heart your violin. The music of a kiss, let me hear you say, I love you.
Ken Dodd, Love is Like a Violin. Ken, that was another one of your big 60s hits.
Yeah, that was the one. That was the first number one. Very precise, very slow, but very precise, because that was the way people did sing in those days. I often wonder whether it might have been better, I don't know, over the years, had I... all the pop singers, they all get like a sort of a transatlantic accent, you know, I love you, baby, you know what I mean? But I could never do that. I don't know. I was taught that the correct way was to do the words as they were meant to be.
Yeah, have you ever worked overseas, Ken?
Yes. I worked in Canada. I've done some in Toronto. I once went to with 600 drunken plumbers. We went to Mexico. This was a special trade thing. Yeah. If they bought so many back boilers, they were given a trip to Acapulco. So I was booked as the turn.
Have you ever tried to crack America or anything like that?
No, I haven't. But I have played to lots of American audiences at the Palladium, because the Palladium is the star. When you play the Palladium, the theatre is the star, and they get all different groups, several nights. Don't forget, I was there from Easter until Christmas. Mm-hmm. And during the season, twice nightly, three times on a Saturday, the entire theatre would be booked out. And you'd know when the acts were in, because as you went on the stage, you were blinded right away by a brilliant flash of light, because all Americans wear spectacles, whether they need them or not. And all Americans wear glasses. Even and the ladies wear the ones with the diamante wings at the side. So everybody was sitting there, and all the light from the stage would bounce back off this sea of glass, and you'd say, oh, I'm there in. Now, some nights you'd go like a rocket. You know, the Yanks would, oh, they'd lap it up, they'd love it. And the other nights, you'd really struggle to fight them all the way.
Do the Americans laugh at the same sort of things that we do,
yes,
or do you have to work harder?
No. Well, you might have to swap some of the idiom, some of the language round. You know, they don't ride in lifts, you know, they ride in elevators. And, you know, there are certain things that you'd have to change. But we soon got used to that. That was okay, yeah.
Well, they're all right with your surreal stuff, because you can be totally surreal when you cry.
Oh, don't forget, they get some wonderful, wonderful comics. Emo Phillips and people like that. Oh, absolutely. And that wonderful man who, he just sort of stands there and comes out with all these crazy lines all the time. I think we've got to admit the Americans invented lunacy. It's only been in craziness. Unless it could be the Australians, of course.
What's this?
Do everything upside down.
What's this painting story of yours?
I am hung. I am hung. I'm in the National Portrait Gallery. A gentleman called David Copley followed me around the country doing sittings and all sketches and things like that. And he produced this wonderful sort of portrait of a comedian who's just come off stage, shattered, standing there in his vest and wondering how some of the gags went, how some of the jokes went, why they laughed and why they didn't laugh. And it's a great sort of puzzle picture, great enigma, I think, because you don't know what he's thinking. I know what he's thinking, but and he's just captured the moment, captured a wonderful moment. And the National Portrait Gallery, the people there, they thought it was these things. I think he's the director. I think he'd seen it at an exhibition, I think, in Oxford. Yeah. And he said, right, we'll have that. And so the trustees bought it for the National Portrait. So I'm hung there amongst some very illustrious people, some great...
Ken, as the years pass, do you find it harder to keep up the momentum? I mean, most people will go on stage and do a 2.5-3 hour show. You are still capable of going on at 7:30 and coming off at 12:45.
Well, I'm stage struck.
You're also like the rest of us, knocking on. Find that a strain?
Oh yes, yes, it takes you out of it. You're exhausted at the end of it, because and you need to top up on plenty of healthy drinks like lager. you have to eat foods that give you energy, and several glucose tablets. That's all. That's all. Just as far as you go. You don't drink during the show. You don't drink at all. Afterwards, you can have a slurp, but not during the show, because you have to watch what you. Keep your brain alert.
But I mean, I wouldn't dare ask you even mention the word retirement, because that's silly. But as far as you're concerned, would you start cutting back and doing a little less, which is still twice as much as anyone else does?
As the bones start hurting, yes. As the bones, as arthritis sets in, yes, I think you have to say, oh, God, oh, dear. Do I have to go up those stairs again to that dressing room?
So people who are going to see you in theatres in the next few months...
I'm not putting it on you. No, not yet. No,
I was
no,
going to say, will they be able to send the baby to the home?
It's a party. It's a fun party. And once you've got the audience on your side and we're all having a ball, you don't want to be a party pooper and go home early. But the doors aren't locked, so you can go. You know, it's all right. But I would say if you're going to stick it out, you know.
Yes, but but there's always a shuffle at one point of the evening when the last bus people leave.
No, because they know when they come. They know a lot of them bring sandwiches and thermos and blankets
bag.
And yeah. No, I love the job, and I love being a comedian, and I love being an entertainer. So while the audience are still there, I'll still keep doing it.
Great stuff. And also the Avenue of the Stars, you're there as well.
Oh, that was a big thing about, they had this big television thing where they're trying to emulate, imitate the American idea, the Los Angeles, where they have the footprints in the cement. We've got, what the heck have we got? Oh, we have stars. It's in the courtyard of the Actors' Church, which is near Covent Garden. And certain people, they selected 100 people who should have their name on a star on this avenue, this walkway. So the Diddy Man.
Does this cover all of time, or just the current era?
No, it goes right back, way back. It goes Sir Laurence Olivier is there, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, Vivian Leigh. Yes, it's all big illustrious
people.
Does that
thrill you to be part of
it? Yeah, of course it does. Yeah, it's nice. Lovely to have a little accolade. It's nice. Here in Radio Merseyside, I was given a sort of a star treatment of a couple of years ago as the top Merseysider. So, yeah, it does mean a lot when your friends and colleagues and neighbours and all get together and say, yeah, you know, you're still doing a good job, Doddy. Keep going.
Have you ever bombed?
Oh, yes. You wouldn't be human, would you, if you hadn't had your share of, it's not always, sometimes you can blame yourself, because, and sometimes you can blame what's going on around you, you know. You never blame the audience. There are no such thing as bad audiences, only bad comedians.
No, it isn't right.
sometimes an audience can be affected by the weather or some bad news or anxiety. Your first 30 seconds you go on the stage, that's when you build the bridge between you and the audience, saying, by Jove, what a beautiful day. And you're supposed to be in then. They're supposed to, well, they have come to see, they've paid you the greatest compliment of all by, you know, buying a ticket to come and see you. So that's a wonderful plus, but you can sometimes if the PA equipment is